Tonight's reading is from Matthew 27, verses 45 to 54. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God."
Now, I understand that tonight the BBC begins its four one-hour session depiction of the final week of Jesus' life called The Passion. I think it's at 8 o'clock, so if you rushed back after church, you might still make it. Apparently, it's written by Frank Deasy, and it stars Joseph Moore as Jesus. I'm actually quite hopeful that it will be a fairly faithful depiction of the events according to the Gospels. And at a time when we often have cause to complain about the secular agenda of the media, I actually want to celebrate this and pray that it will be very useful. I'm very excited to discover that the Telegraph was giving out free extracts from Mark's Gospel today for people to actually read the account from the Gospel alongside watching the film. Well, that's fantastic, isn't it? And let's pray that many people will actually read those accounts and be stirred to think and to find out more. Of course, many will struggle to understand the meaning or the significance of that amazing, world-changing week. And I suppose that's perhaps the main reason we come to church each week, to hear somebody to explain to us the significance of Christ and his death from the whole of the Bible. We come, don't we, to have somebody explain to us what the Bible means. And that's what we're going to do as we look at this account from Matthew's Gospel. Now, in Matthew's version of Jesus' death, that's just been read to us, he emphasizes that Jesus' death fulfilled many promises made centuries earlier in the Old Testament part of the Bible. You may know that the four Gospel writers who compiled their Gospel accounts from eyewitness records, either records they themselves have made, because they were there, or from others who were there, each of them emphasizes something slightly different, much as you would expect from four journalists. For example, if they're reflecting upon Wales's historic Grand Slam win yesterday in Cardiff, and worthy of that title they certainly were. Well, if you read four journalists writing about that, each would take a slightly different angle on the match. Same events, true events, but a slightly different perspective, according to the agenda of the writer. And so it is with the four Gospel writers. So we find, for example, that in Mark's account, he emphasizes that Christ is the suffering servant promised in the Old Testament. In Luke, well, Luke emphasizes that Christ's death was as the Savior of the world. John emphasizes that Christ's death is where the Son glorifies the Father. But here in Matthew emphasizes that Christ's death is in accordance with the promises of the Old Testament, and in particular that he dies like great King David said he would. And we need to recognize, you see, that the history of Jesus' death, which is after all confirmed by non-Christian historians from the first century, was described in great detail by the prophets of the Old Testament writing centuries beforehand. This was not, you see, the sad end to the career of a promising young preacher, but the triumphant conclusion to God's great plan of salvation that had been published for centuries. There are three features of the account that Matthew seems to emphasize, and I've put them there on the sheet for you. Firstly, there's the darkness of judgment. Let's look at verse 45 before we see it described there. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. Well, that's 3 hours. Imagine the middle of a Palestinian hot day, and the sun is shining, and it's noon. And from noon until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it goes completely dark. It's not just a passing cloud. This is not just in an isolated area. The whole region is plunged into eerie darkness. We know that historically it was the wrong time for an eclipse. One of the secular historians actually records this great darkness. And I don't know whether you were awake, you know, a couple of years ago when there was that great eclipse of the sun. You know, that eerie light. It was extraordinary, wasn't it? And wherever you went, there was this weird light. Well, this went on for 3 hours. So everybody must have been thinking, what on earth is going on? But it seems as you read the Old Testament that, in fact, this whole episode of darkness has been arranged by the Creator to signify something, to signify his judgment upon the sin of the world. If you know your Old Testament well, you may know that near the beginning of the Old Testament, in the history of the exodus of the people of Israel when they were rescued from slavery in Egypt, that God brought darkness over the land of Egypt just before the lambs of sacrifice were killed, through which Israel was saved from their slavery. In the same way as darkness now precedes the death of Jesus, the sacrifice for our liberation from sin. Later on, the prophet Joel promised darkness on the day of the Lord, when the Lord would come in mighty power to deliver his people, but also in judgment upon sin. The prophet Isaiah promised darkness when God would punish the evil of the world and all the corruption that people bring into his creation, that he would punish it on a day of darkness. And the prophet Amos in Amos 8 promised darkness like the mourning of grief for a dying only son. Let me read to you the words from Amos. They're strikingly accurate, written 800 years beforehand. God says, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. I will turn your religious feasts into mourning and all your singing into weeping. I will make all of you wear sackcloth and shave your heads. I'll make that time like mourning for an only son. Well, that's extraordinary, isn't it? As the Passover feast was going on, the place went dark at noon, as God grieved for the death of his only and beloved Son. The living God, you see, caused this darkness to fulfill his promise of the day of the Lord when he was punishing our sin and as he grieved the death of his only Son. It's as if God causes the whole of creation to join him in his sorrow as his beloved hangs naked and wounded and dying on the cross. So firstly, there's the darkness of judgment. Secondly, verse 46, there's the cry of rejection. Verse 46. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is Hebrew and Aramaic mixed up. It means, my God, why have you forsaken me? I think this cry of Jesus shortly before he dies is meant to reveal his own perspective upon his death. It explains his understanding of why he is dying. Many of you will remember the film Braveheart. Any Scots here? Always Scots. Where's Cameron? Yes, Braveheart. Favorite film. Favorite film, Cameron? One of them. Must be up the top there. Braveheart, if you remember, it depicts the life of William Wallace, the great Scottish hero. And you may remember that towards the end of the film, William Wallace, played by that great Scottish actor, Mel Gibson, from Australia, as he's being disemboweled by the wicked English, cries out one last word as he dies. Remember what the word is? Freedom! He yells, you know, as he's being disemboweled. It's quite pretty clever, actually. But what is Braveheart doing that for? What's he doing? He's saying, this is what I've died for. I've died for the freedom of my people. And I think it's something like that as Jesus cries out at this point. He's revealing why he's dying. And he's quoting the first verse of Psalm 22, written 1,000 years beforehand by King David, describing the death of God's chosen king. Let me read you a few words from that psalm, because although it's all these quotes are sort of mixed up in the psalm, they describe with extraordinary accuracy what happened to Jesus. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him, they say. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones, for they're not broken. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments amongst them and cast lots for my clothing. Which we know is what the Roman soldiers were doing as they gambled for Jesus' clothing at the foot of the cross. But the psalm begins, my God, why have you forsaken or abandoned me? It's not just that Jesus felt abandoned and lonely. He's explaining that he really is being abandoned. He's being thrown into the horrors of hell as he is cut off from the presence of God and from all that is good. And the question why, which comes in that first verse, rings out over the crowds and over the centuries. Why have you abandoned me? Until many of us realize, of course, the answer to that question is, for me. He suffered that appalling, hellish suffering for us as he died in our place on the cross. Mel Gibson, of course, in his film, The Passion of the Christ, expresses that understanding with his only involvement in the film, where apparently it's actually his arm that is hammering at the nails, as it were, to hammer them into Jesus. Most chilling to me about this quote is that Jesus had clearly read and learned Psalm 22. With all its horrific description of the death of this king, and yet still, knowing Psalm 22, he walked into Jerusalem. He surrendered himself to the soldiers. He lay back on the cross and was staked out, knowing what was coming, because he loves us that much. And then thirdly, the third detail is the vinegar of contempt in verse 48. Let's read from verse 48. Immediately one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." Now, it appears that one of the crowd seems to have thought to alleviate Jesus' suffering with a sponge soaked in cheap vinegar. The rest of the crowd is just watching with that sort of twisted fascination that we all have for blood. Maybe you're not like me, but don't you slow down when you're on a motorway, there's been an accident? Am I the only one who does that? Well, everybody else seems to do it as well, so it's not just me. And that's the crowd are just watching this man die. Well, the three of them die, Jesus and the criminals beside him. But as they're watching, Jesus' words, "Eloi, Eloi," which is my God," sounds like the name Elijah. And some evident thought he might be calling down the great miracle-working prophet to come and help him. But unknown to the crowd, this detail was again fulfilling something promised in the Old Testament, in Psalm 69, where King David laments the persecution of the king. Let me quote, it says, "I looked for sympathy, but there was none, for comforters, but I found none. They put gall in my food and gave me vinegar for my thirst." It's poetry, of course, describing the agony of a king who's being persecuted by the people. But it describes precisely what happened to Jesus. Now, the point here, the point that Matthew surely wants us to understand, is that it is obvious that these unplanned fulfillments of ancient promises show that Jesus was dying according to God's great plan. Known to God, known to the people, known by Jesus, published in the Old Testament, as Christ had repeatedly explained. And the reason he did it is that God took flesh to swap places with us, to die our death as the lightning conductor for what we all deserve, so that we can be free of it forever. In other words, Christ came from heaven to die in our place for our sins. Now, we all know what sins are, don't we? I mean, we're not silly enough to think, you know, there's nothing wrong. I mean, if there's nothing wrong in our lives, of course, we won't want Jesus. But for the rest of us who know there's plenty wrong in our hearts, this is the best news ever. Jesus had earlier said this. He said, "What comes out of us is what makes us unclean. For out of our hearts come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make us unclean." Now, there's a list from Jesus. I mean, you'd have to be really bad to be guilty of all those things, but surely we can recognize some of those things. You know, whether it's the envy or the sexual immorality, whatever it is, we know that our hearts are far from pure and clean. But those are really only the symptoms. Those are the kind of particular symptoms of the disease of sin in our hearts, which is one of rebellion against God. You see, what we all like to do, we really resent God's rule in our lives, so that in our hearts what we find is this natural resentment of God. "I wish God would joy or stay out of my life. Let me get on with it. Stay out of my way. I want to run my life my way." It's really a declaration of independence against him. And Matt Fuller pointed me to the account a few years ago of a tiny East Sussex hamlet of Ashurst Wood, which declared itself independent from the rest of the UK. "The People's Republic of Ashurst Wood Nation State, Prawns for short, announced its break from British taxation and self-governance on the 1st of January 2000. A revolutionary committee was formed. They were quite serious. They wrote to the Queen and to Tony Blair to declare their independence. They wrote a constitution, established checkpoints on the road to East Grinstead, which is where most invasions were likely to come from. They issued passports and required visas from all foreigners, that is outside their little nation state, for anybody to visit. And they were serious. They even appointed a colonel in charge of defence to make sure that no one would invade the Prawns estate. Of course, the whole thing collapsed in the end because they couldn't issue visas fast enough for all the milkmen and postmen and delivery trucks that needed to visit their state to give them what they required. And so the whole rebellion fell apart. Now, we smile at that, don't we? I mean, rightly so. We just think, how ridiculous. Sorry, is there anybody here who was actually involved in that little escapade? I mean, you do think to yourself, don't you? How absurd. How absurd to think you could just declare yourself independent of the rest of the country. But it's about as ridiculous as our declaration to God. When we say to God, I'm going to do without him. I don't need him. I'm just going to run my life my way. The fact that my very being is sustained by him. I'm going to ignore that. I don't need God. I'm going to run my life my way. And I'm going to keep his stupid laws out of my... I'm going to declare myself independent of him. We'll try not to think about death and what lies beyond. I'm just going to be independent. And it's just so ridiculous to think that we could live independently of God. And of course, if we carry on like that all our lives, telling God to push off and leave us alone and let us run our own lives and please stay out of the way, we can't expect to be with him when we die. We cannot expect to live with God, having treated him like that all our lives. And yet, in his mercy and his forgiveness and kindness, he took flesh in Jesus to take all the consequences for the way we treat him on himself when he died on the cross. I'm a great addict of the TV series 24, starring Kiefer Sutherland. And some of you will know that the trailer for Series 6 had depiction of all kinds of dramatic explosions and great music and all the rest of it. And then these words came flashing up on screen. "Threat will rise. Fear will grow. Our only hope lies with one man for America to survive. Jack Bauer must die." And the point of the trailer, of course, is that to save millions of ordinary people, the innocent Jack Bauer must be sacrificed. Sorry to just point to you, it never actually happened. It's a great story, but it's just made up. But it is, of course, a kind of echo of the ultimate and noble heroism of Jesus as he died in our place on the cross. And of course, he didn't die as a helpless victim. Notice what happens next in verse 50. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. There's the rather twisted idea going around at the moment that somehow Jesus was the sort of helpless victim of God the Father, and that God just picked on poor old Jesus and smacked him on the cross. Now, of course, nothing like that happened at all. Jesus was a grown-up. He willingly walked into Jerusalem. He surrendered himself out of great love for us and out of love for his Father. He surrendered himself to death on the cross. And even as he dies, it's not as if anybody takes his life from him. He gives up his spirit. He surrendered himself to death as he dies in our place on the cross. This is the language of willing self-sacrifice. So Matthew wants to emphasize that just as promised in the Old Testament, Christ came to swap places with us on the cross. And at this point, you might say to yourself, good for Jesus, well done. But what is the impact? Why do we celebrate this fact? Why do we call it Good Friday when he died? Well, Matthew explains three benefits of Jesus' death, which are absolutely mind-blowing. Look with me at verse 51. Here's the first of them. He died to give us access to God. Look at verse 51. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, the curtain referred to here is in the temple in the center of Jerusalem. Herod's temple, massive, great big temple, you know, lovely, great marble blocks. Huge, great blocks of marble. Apparently, they glistened in the sun from miles and miles around, all inlaid with gold. It was one of the wonders of the world. It was just an extraordinary building. And right at the heart of it was this huge curtain, 80 foot high, right across the kind of holy place, right in the middle of the temple. But although this temple curtain was beautiful, one piece of material embroidered with gold and crimson and purple, it was a magnificent piece of material. Actually, it was a dreadful symbol, because it symbolized the barrier between human beings and God. For you see, the holy place behind it symbolized where only God could be, and everyone else is left outside. As if to teach in this symbolism that God is so pure and good and holy that he cannot have corrupt and selfish people like us living with him without being consumed. And so this great barrier, see, this curtain, was a terrible symbol. But as Jesus died, and Matthew says, at this moment, and it wasn't just somebody passing with a snag, you know, it wasn't torn from the bottom, but from the top to the bottom, from God to man, this great barrier was torn open. And as Jesus' body was torn on the cross, the barrier was torn in the temple. And the way was opened up into the presence of God. And there are no more barriers. This great barrier was torn down once and for all. Of course, all the priests who worked in the temple, supposed to be making sacrifices, they lost their jobs that day. There were 5,000 of them made redundant. So, of course, you know what they did? They got out the Singer sewing machine and they quickly sewed it up again to pretend that there was still a barrier so they could still keep their jobs. And people have been pretending there's a barrier ever since. But the barrier came down on that day. There's no more sacrifices for sins necessary. No more priests to offer them either. Because on that day, the barrier was torn open and the way was open for us to walk into the presence of God. And now, whoever we are, we can be friends with God. We can live with God. We can live in his presence in this life and forevermore because the barrier is broken down. And that is fantastic. I don't know whether you remember in November of 1989, when the Berlin Wall, the barrier between East and West Germany, symbolizing that the hostility of the Cold War, was finally broken down. Do you remember the film shots of people on the wall, you know, hammering with, you know, sledgehammers and so on, and as the slabs of wall were broken down, you know, families and friends were reunited after many years. It's a wonderful scene, isn't it, as the barrier is broken down. And even more wonderful is the day between when the barrier between God and man was broken down finally, and we can now live with God because of Jesus. A friend of mine's son yesterday went to be the mascot for Blackburn Rovers. He's an absolutely avid Blackburn Rovers fan. And this boy is about 9 years old. This is the most exciting thing that's ever happened in his entire life. I saw him yesterday as he and his dad were heading off to the train station. And he was jumping. He was like he was on springs. He was just not standing still. I wound down the window and said to him, I said, are you excited about going? And he leapt up and down, like on springs. His knees were hitting his shoulders and down again. And you see, he went to Blackburn Rovers, and he went into the changing rooms. And he spent half an hour with the team. And he talked to Mark Hughes. And he talked to all the players. And he was speechless with delight. It was the highlight of his life. Now, if it was Old Trafford, I could understand it. But anyway, it was the most exciting day of his life, and his parents went along, you see. It was so exciting. And it struck me as I was hearing his excitement. He was so excited to be in the room with Mark Hughes and the Blackburn Rovers team. How much more exciting to live in the presence of God and to be with God forever. Sometimes we think, oh, well, who would want to go there? That's because you don't know how good God is yet. He's so wonderful and marvelous. To be with him, you'll be jumping for joy. Your knees will be over your shoulders with excitement. When we can walk into the presence of God and see him face to face and enjoy his goodness forever and ever, it'll be better even than the Blackburn Rovers changing room. To be in the presence of God because the barrier is broken down. Next, not only to give us access to God, verse 51, but also to give us life from God, verse 52. The tombs broke open, and the bodies of many holy people who died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Now, I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. It must have been some earthquake, mustn't it, to have shaken the rock tombs so much that some of them were split open, and some people who died came back to life. They weren't resurrected like Jesus. They weren't fit for heaven. They just came back to life, as Jesus had done many times before. They were not the only ones. But, of course, on the day of Jesus' resurrection, they appeared and they imagine what happened in Jerusalem. Imagine the chaos. You know, and you open the door. I've remarried. I've got four kids. You know, I don't know. I just can't imagine the chaos in Jerusalem. These people who've died, and now they're alive again. Of course, they died again along with everybody else. But the reason for this happening, it's because Jesus has died. And when he died on that cross, you see, because he took the punishment of sin, the power of death over us is broken. And although we'll die like anybody else and our bodies will rot and we'll be buried or cremated, the point is now that when we are all risen to stand before Jesus, we will not have to be sent away in permanent death. We'll be welcomed into the presence of God because the power of death over us is broken. Because there is no guilt, there is no sin. It's all been taken by Jesus. And the power of death is broken and cracked open forevermore. So his death, you see, has given us access to God. He's given us life from God to spend forever enjoying it. And lastly, he's given us the knowledge of God. Look with me at verse 54. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." I love this story. I've told it before. You have to forgive me. But John Wayne, the American actor, when he was playing the part of the Roman centurion in Cecil B. DeMille's version of this, I think it was called The Greatest Story Ever Told or something. Apparently, John Wayne delivered the line in a sort of rather flat way. He said, "Surely he was the Son of God." I can't do American accents, but anyway. "Surely he was the Son of God." And the director said to him, "Look, John, you need a bit more awe in your voice." So John Wayne thought for a moment and he went, "Oh, surely he was the Son of God." Now, I don't think that's the point. The point is that the soldier, you see, this centurion, this hardened death squad captain or centurion, is terrified. Terrified. Not a dead body, as you've seen plenty of those before. But it says, when he saw the earthquake and all that had happened, eerie darkness for 3 hours, right? Massive earthquake. And no doubt also, as he heard the voice of Jesus, as he saw Jesus speaking, as Jesus was hanging on the cross, you know, and speaking to people around him the most beautiful words, forgiving even his own executioners, looking after his mother, talking to those around him, declaring forgiveness to the criminal who hung next to him as he's fighting for breath himself moments before dying. And as the centurion saw all this, the penny finally dropped. This is the Son of God. And no doubt with terror, as he thought to himself, what have we done? What have we done? We've just nailed this man to this cross, and now I see he is the Son of God, and I've treated him so dreadfully. No wonder he was terrified. Perhaps some of us this evening might even now be realizing, as the penny is dropping, that we've dismissed this Jesus and we've tried as hard as the centurion to get rid of him. And now we realize, no, this was the Son of God dying for us on the cross. And look at the way we've treated him. You'd want to be terrified when you realize that's what you've done. But the great thing that Matthew wants us to understand, you see, is that as Jesus dies, it becomes obvious what God is like. See, it struck me, God could have been any number of things. God could be the distant great power who cares not tuppence for us. God doesn't have to be. He doesn't have to be kind, does he? He can just be the way he is. And maybe he's so distant and unconcerned that he's just not doesn't care about us. Or maybe, in fact, he's a cruel tyrant who loves to administer pain to us all. He could be like that. I mean, I can't change him if that's the way he is. There's nothing we can do about it. How wonderful then, how fantastic to discover that actually God has made himself known in Jesus to be so loving and so kind, so full of compassion and love, even for wretched people like us, that he's willing to take flesh and die in our place on the cross because he loves us so much. Does that not thrill your heart to discover that that's how God is after all? In the death of Jesus, we see the character of God most clearly displayed. Do you see now why Christians want to celebrate Easter? It's not the chocolate. It's not the chocolate. It's that Jesus swapped places with us on the cross to win us access to God so we can be friends with God forever, to give us life from God, to enjoy it with him forever, to give us the knowledge of God, to show us how good he is. And perhaps if some of us are here tonight who are not yet Christians, perhaps you have come with a Christian tonight and you find them intriguing, even strange, because they're ordinary and normal in every other aspect of life, and yet they stare you in the face and they say, do you know, I know God personally. And you say, what, do you hear voices then? No, don't hear voices. What, can you see him in visions then? No, don't see visions. Well, what's it like then? I know him. I have a spiritual relationship with God. When I read his word, it means everything to me. When I talk to him in prayer, I know he hears me. I can't explain it, but it's real. It's the relationship that Jesus died to win for us. And that's what we're talking about. And it can be your relationship too. It can be your relationship too. And why wouldn't you want to go in? Why wouldn't you want to go in and to get to know God and to live forever with him, to enjoy his goodness and his love and his compassion forevermore? It cost Christ his life to win it for you. How could you ignore it? Well, many of us, of course, will be celebrating Easter, thrilled that Jesus died for us. But if there are any here who've not yet become Christians, and you think to yourself, this has got to stop. I've got to start a relationship with God. I've got to begin the Christian life. You can. You can. And I think an easy way to describe what you need to do is, obviously you need to speak to God in your hearts, in prayer. And we just need to say three things. Sorry, thank you, please. Sorry is to apologize, to say sorry for rebelling against God all these years.
sorry. Thank you. Thank you for coming to die in my place on the cross, to take the penalty that should be mine. Thank you so much for loving me like that. Please, please can I come in and get to know you and to live with you and to enjoy your goodness forevermore? Sorry, thank you, please. That's how you become a Christian. Many of us have done it already. Perhaps there are some who need to do it for the first time tonight. So let's bow our heads and pray together. Just a moment to collect our thoughts and to consider whether perhaps we need to begin a relationship with God. Let me now lead us in a prayer. I'll speak out loud. Why don't you just echo these words quietly in your heart, and I promise you that God is listening. Dear God, we want to say sorry. We want to apologize for rebelling against you all these years. We also want to say thank you. Thank you for coming to die on that cross in our place. Thank you for taking the penalty that should be ours, because you love us so much. And we want to say, please, please can we come into your presence? It does seem a bit nervy, but we want to get to know you. We want to live with you forever. We want to enjoy your goodness and kindness forever. So please, can we live with you from now on? And we ask it because Jesus has died. Amen.